Good afternoon. Education Finance Committee will come to order. Our Representative Poston, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes for March 22nd?
Madam Chair, I have, and I would move to approve the minutes from March 22nd.
All right. Representative Poston moves approval of the minutes. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, all in favor of Representative Poston's motion to approve the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Poston. All right, so today we will devote our time during our regular committee time, and then if need be this evening, and I'll announce at floor session what time we're reconvening to take public testimony on House Bill 890, and I suspect the delete all amendment primarily. And so we will get going with that. Just we have an extensive list, I think more than 40, that have let us know that they'd like to testify. There may be others who hadn't signed up. It's my goal to try to let everyone who wishes to testify, but we will limit that with only a couple of exceptions, say for the commissioner and others, to try to limit their testimony to about 2 minutes if you can. So we're going to time you. We'll give you a signal, and if you would, just please wrap up when you get the sign to complete your remarks. And with that, Representative Markberg.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering, can we go back to the spreadsheet quickly before we go to testifiers, just because there's been a lot of numbers and percentages of increase, and some's over base, some is over last biennium, and I think when we're going to hear a lot of testifiers that we kind of understand the difference. So I'm just wondering if we could go back to one line on the spreadsheet, Madam Chair, just so as everyone's kind of talking, we're talking apples to apples, and it gets confusing. You talk biennial, but time frames, we talk
base or over
right.
By him, yes. Yes, and I will note though that the spreadsheet, obviously there was an error pointed out yesterday, and for Ms. Adrians is having to work feverishly and probably literally feverishly because she has a cold, but to update the spreadsheet. So we won't have a completely revised new spreadsheet until tomorrow, but we can talk off of the one that was handed out yesterday. So,
Madam Chair, I really appreciate that. And it's when you get to the very last page, page 6 of 6, which would be lines 231 and 232.
Yeah.
And when you go to the columns labeled A, B, C, and D, and for example, under letter A and letter B, you have a 2.6% increase for fiscal 18 and then 2.9% for 2019. And Ms. Adrians, if I could ask a question, that is over the fiscal year 16-17 budget. Is that correct? Or from the earlier buy-in, and that's not over base, I don't believe.
Ms. Adrians.
Madam Chair and Representative Marquardt, if the calculation is correct, which it's quite possible if not, but if it is, what I would have attempted to do is do it from the previous year so that the House recommendation for 2018, the increase would be over the based off of the February forecast, the fiscal year 2017.
Okay.
And then the 19 number should be over the previous year as well. So it should be reflecting an annual increase. What's the goal? I will double check.
Yes. Thank you. Madam Chair. Ms. Adrians, thank you so much for that. So, I think it's important to remember that of the total education number we're looking at in the chair's bill is about a $1.1 billion increase over the previous biennium. And yet, probably a little over $800 million of that is just before we do anything. That's about $800 million increase from this biennium, from last biennium to this biennium, is just current law. And if you look at the forecast, and I talked about this in Ways and Means last night, It's mainly attributed to two things. Increase in student per pupil count, which we're going to have about 8,000 more students the next 2 years than we have in the earlier 2 years, about 8,000 increase. And so when you look at the general ed funding, that's about $320 million, a lot of it because of the pupil count. And then there's about $260, $270 million increase in special ed, which is the student count, plus that has an inflator in it, and I think it's around 4.6% or something like that. And then the other, that's about $650 million of that $800, mainly on student count. And then remaining about $110, $130 million is equalization, and a lot of that in the long-term facilities maintenance that is going to be phased in the next couple years. So a point being is that if we did nothing here, that would increase $800 million, and I'm sure if you talk to superintendents, a lot of testifiers here today, well, a lot of people are talking about all this new money. If you were to say, if we do nothing, how that would impact them, I think it would be pretty severe. So the amount of money in this bill over base, which is about $269 million, is, if I calculated for 2018, it's about $94 million new dollars, which is about 1% over base. And in the next year, 2019, it's about $175 million increase, or about 1.9% over base, or a total of about 1.5% over base in this biennium. So I just think it's important to remember, because I know it was mentioned last night by Chair Knobloch that, you know, we're increasing education funding by 6.4%. But don't try to tell superintendents and school board members that, because three-quarters of it is in these dollars because of increased enrollment. So I think only being fair, I think when we kind of say some of those numbers, while they are accurate, absolutely, they don't tell the entire truth of the situation that school districts are facing out there, and the fact of the matter that the bill we have before us will increase the funding over the biennium from the base, from current law, about 1.5%. So I think as we hear the testifiers talk about inflation, and so what is inflation? In the forecast that came out in February, it said the forecast or the inflation the next 2 years is going to be 2.1% each of the next 2 years. The most recent Bureau of Labor Statistics show that from February to February, it has gone up 2.4%. So when we talk about the funding, and you might hear people talk about inflation in here, that's about where we're at, between 2 and 2.5%. So, Madam Chair, thank you so much for letting me indulge in this. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. And, you know, I appreciate the remarks you're making, and I think just the only thing I'd add to it is, you know, both perspectives are true. I mean, both are true, and you did point that out. I mean, we can count how much more is being spent per the previous biennium or how much more over base, and both are accurate. And, you know, the base, I think for a lot of people, well, for many people maybe in this room, gets into sort of in the weeds of the budget process here, which I think for a lot of average Minnesotans maybe goes by the wayside. But, you know, there were some significant funding increases of new programs like the long-term facilities maintenance program that was again enacted in the previous biennium, but the bulk of the funding increases through the equalization comes online in the 18-19 biennium. So again, you know, fair enough to count it either way you want to, but and you know, again, fair point. So appreciate that. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just saying if we're going to review the spreadsheet, I would like that. But I don't understand completely what we meant when we went through it the first time with the delinking. I think we did that in two places or three places. And so if we could explain it so that I can recall what it really means.
Okay. All right. So, Mr. Strom, can I, or Ms. Adrians?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, would you mind repeating the question? We were asking Mr. Kennedy to turn his ring off.
Well, Mr. Kennedy.
All the technology problems, and I'm on the record.
Thank you. I was just, if we're going through, there's three or four places where we say it's delinked, and I don't quite understand what we mean by that. So if I could have a repetition of the word, or what we mean by delinked.
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, so when we increase the formula, so the 1.5% increase each year that's in here, and that changes the number, the 6,067 number, up. There are a number of programs that automatically increase along with that. So if you don't want everything to increase along with it, what we call it, we call it delinking it, so that those programs, and in this area of the budget, it's the compensatory, the non-public pupil aid, the non-public pupil transportation, and I forgot to add ECFE is also delinked. So what it means is they will continue to get funding, but their funding will remain in line with the amount of $6,067 per pupil for the basic formula allowance.
And will go up.
It won't increase like it would if you kept it linked along with the increase of 1.5%.
And Madam Chair, you
understood that whole thing all along.
Yes, right? Ma'am.
And okay. Madam Chair, could I ask one more question? Could you tell me where the governor recommended funding to school districts for pensions? Is that money in here?
Representative Murphy, there is no funding allocated to that, but I don't know if is there a line indicating in the governor's recommendations?
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy and members, if you have your spreadsheet, if you look at line 19, this is the governor's initiative to increase pension aid to districts. And he recommends about $68.5 million in the current biennium.
And that's the only place where that sum is mentioned on this full six pages.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Well, I think we probably better turn to our public testimony and get that rolling. I'm just going to ask by a show of hands if there's anyone who has signed up to testify who has traveled more than 50 miles or a distance and cannot be here later. Okay. And, sir, can you just tell us your name?
Chris Belmont.
Chris Belmont. Okay. Oh, okay. I see you right here. And, yes, in the front row. Who, either
I'm Ben McCoy and
Julie Workman.
Okay. Okay, so I assume for all of you raising your hand, your preference would be to testify before we end here this afternoon and not come back. Okay? And one more up there.
Amanda Ryan.
Oh, gotcha. And where are you from? All right. Yes.
Mary Lockhart Finley.
Okay. Bandy. Okay. And again, everyone who's, if you need to be more than 50 miles, And I did have two other people who indicated they can only be here until 1:30, and so we're going to get them on really quickly, and then we'll go to the commissioner. And I apologize, Commissioner. I'm trying to accommodate schedules as best I can. So Diane Halsey and Ethan Roberts, if you would come down. And we'll start with you, Ms. Halsey, and then Mr. Roberts. And I know you both had commitments you had to leave for. So if you would each be very brief. I'm asking, again, each testifier to limit to 2 minutes if possible. We would appreciate it. And please just introduce yourself for the record so we have that on the tape. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Loon, and thank you for accommodating me. My name is Diane Halsey, and I am the Senior Vice President of Family Engagement at Think Small. I am also the one of the programs I oversee is we're the regional administrators in the 7 County metro area for the Early Learning Scholarship Program. We also administer the Hennepin County Scholarships. Today I wanted to testify in support of two items in the bill. The first one is in support of allowing scholarships to be used at all parent-aware rated programs and pushing back the date of requiring them to only be used at 3- and 4-star programs. This encourages programs at all levels to come into the parent-aware programs. And this past year, I can say that it's been a real hardship for many parents to find programs in their area that are close to them that are only 3- and 4-star rated. So I'm just, you know, here just in support of pushing back that deadline, because I think it'll help parents to give them more options and also increase the number of family child care programs that can be used, where scholarships can be used, because there's more 1- and 2-star rated programs that are family child care programs. In particular, this is important because especially in the metro area, many of the programs that are coming into Parent Aware are programs of color, providers of color, English language learners, and they're oftentimes coming in first rated at 1- and 2-star rated programs, so this really increases the options for parents. Lastly, I also wanted to testify on the prioritizing children that are experiencing homelessness, as well as adding children that are in protective services. Currently in Southern County metro area, there's about 13% of children that we are serving that are homeless. We've worked really well this past year with the Department of Education to really target these children, and there's a great need for that. In addition, adding the protective services, children that are in protective services, is also a high need that I fully support. I'm also the former executive director of Reuben Lynn Family Services, where we used to really target children that were in child protective services or on their way there, and providing high-quality care for them. And it really helped in actually helping to prepare them for kindergarten. So I'm also here in full support of that.
Thank you very much, Ms. Halsey. We appreciate that, and thank you for keeping it brief. We appreciate it. Mr. Roberts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ethan Roberts, and I am the Director of Government Affairs for the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas. I'm here today to express our heartfelt gratitude to the Chair and your staff for the confidence that you have placed in the Parent-Child Home Program with your budget. For over 50 years, this evidence-based program has closed the achievement gap by investing in economically and educationally disadvantaged children, ages 2 to 4, and successfully strengthened parents to prepare their kids for lifelong school success. In 2006, when Jewish Family Children's Service of Minneapolis brought this program to Minnesota, we were only able to serve 20 families, thanks to the generosity of a private donor. Because we knew, however, that this program of targeted twice-weekly home visits 30 weeks a year for 2 years, have been proven to make it 50% more likely that children who participated would be ready for kindergarten, and 50% less likely that the same children would be referred to special education services. We knew it was imperative that we bring this program to scale. Today, thanks to the ongoing leadership of Chair Loon and the financial support of Minnesota and our private donors, I'm proud to say that we've grown the program from 20 families to 200 families, and because of this budget, we are on track to reach 300 families. This initiative has always been bipartisan, And though I know we aren't supposed to acknowledge the other body, it would be disrespectful not to thank Senator Terry Bonoff, retired Senator Terry Bonoff, for her terrific partnership with Chitterlune over the years. And we're also grateful to Senator Paul Anderson, who has enthusiastically picked up that baton and is our new lead Senate author. Finally, in conclusion, on behalf of the JFCS, I'd like to invite all the members of the committee to the annual Parent-Child Home Program graduation. It's at 2 o'clock on Sunday, June 4th, at the Alice Smith Elementary School in Hopkins. It's a really wonderful experience, and I think you'll all enjoy it. Thank you again to the committee and to the chair for allowing us to testify today.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Roberts. We appreciate you being here. Commissioner, thank you very much for your patience. I appreciate it. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Brenda Caselius, Commissioner of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to House File 890. This is our seventh session together. We've been together in times when we're facing down a $5 billion deficit and a $2.8 billion that was still owed to our schools. The final bills we've passed together have focused on giving every student a great teacher, a great start, and the resources to our schools they need to pay their bills and hold down growing costs. But today, the bill before us does not continue that work. Your bill lowers the standards for teacher quality, disinvests in every kid getting a great start, and woefully underfunds our public schools. In our early meetings this year, like you, I worried about a low target. The governor invested $609 million in his first budget and then another $100 million in a supplemental budget. The $258 million you propose in this bill doesn't even come close to the $709 million Governor Dayton wants to invest in our children and our shared future as Minnesotans. But an inadequate target is no excuse for a bill that pulls the rug out from under our children in our highest poverty schools, from our Native American kids at BIE schools, and from our littlest learners trying to get a great start, not to mention our hardworking teachers we are anxious to retain. Recently, Speaker Dowd stated that his top three priorities would be taxes, transportation, and education, specifically to close achievement gaps. But this bill not only ignores this promise, but undermines the recent strides we've made together, bipartisan in a bipartisan way, to support schools and districts and dismantles the equity we've worked so hard to create in our formula. Minnesota is and has been a leader in public education, in public school choice, and in public schools that parents believe in. 90% of Minnesota families choose our public schools because they believe that they best provide opportunities that prepare our children for success in life. They believe in the power of public schools to serve as the foundation of a strong democracy, one that will produce productive, engaged, and highly skilled workforce. Our kids deserve better. There are numerous ways this bill falls short of what students and schools need to produce better outcomes and close achievement gaps. Let's start with the bottom line. The governor proposed a real formula increase of 2% each year of the biennium. He proposed help with pension relief so districts didn't get lost with holding the bank. He proposed covering some of the unfunded special ed costs to continue to bring down those growing costs. But you propose 1.5% increase each year. It is an increase that relies on shifts and cuts and diverts money from our poorest kids. No funding to special ed, no pension help, while costs are continuing to grow for our public schools. The governor proposed significant and needed funding for every district that applied for preschool. 269 districts out of 325 from every corner of the state. Please look at the map that I gave you. There's certainly a colorful map because there is a demand. An additional 13,800 kids are waiting to be served. Parents are choosing and wanting, and families want to be covered. But your bill cuts pre-K funding. And not only that, it cuts Pathway 2 funding, shutting the door to any new districts wanting to access this needed funding and turning the lights out on the 74 existing pre-K programs. The pre-K funding cut in this bill currently serves more than 3,300 children and families across our state. Many of these 74 districts made significant investments
in pre-K facilities, changed grade configurations, hired staff to run programs, bought new curriculum, made huge sacrifices because families said they wanted the pre-K investment in their school. Your bill turns our back on each one of these communities. It also does a second blow and cut to 279 districts by eliminating Pathway 2 scholarships. But school districts aren't the only ones hurt by Pathway 2 elimination. We won't fund 122 licensed child care centers or 107 Head Starts, our poorest kids, or 7 private family home providers that get Pathway 2. 534 programs altogether will lose Pathway 2 scholarships. The governor's budget would improve equitable, stable, and predictable funding for every single school, but your bill undercuts compensatory funding for our poor kids by a real cut of over $2 million and delinking and then redistributing the money based on test participation instead of concentrated poverty. Just last year, the Education Trust studied state funding equity across the nation, and I must tell you, it felt pretty good not to finally be at the bottom of an equity list. We were ranked number one and number two for how we fund high poverty, high minority schools. The governor proposes continuing the historic tribal contract aid that gained national attention for equitably providing resources to BIE schools in dire need of support to address the needs of American Indian children. But your bill ignores that need by discontinuing that funding, resulting in real cuts to our tribal schools and to our Minnesota Indian children who have just as much right to an excellent education as every other child in the state. Your bill moves backward in our efforts to achieve greater equity for our high school students by setting high expectations of college or career for every single student. Now poor students, many of whom might be the first in their family to go to college, will have to figure out how to navigate the paperwork, pay up front to take the ACT before getting reimbursed, and this will likely result in some of them never even trying to take this important exam. This kind of reimbursement scheme does not simplify or fairly provide every student with the same chance to pursue the dream of a higher education. Matter of fact, we don't make these same reimbursement requirements for AP exams, IB exams, or any other PSEO participation. The governor proposes investing in our agency to better support kids, teachers, and schools, but your budget cuts critical operating funds for MDE and does not fund needed IT infrastructure improvements that will significantly hamper our ability to produce critical information that schools, communities, even yourselves as legislators need in an accurate and timely manner, including state aid payments for school districts, charter schools, cooperatives, and intermediate schools, property tax levy limitations for school districts, November and February budget forecasts, fiscal notes, enrollment information, audits to ensure that state aids paid to districts are based on accurate reporting of school finance statistics to the federal government and public, financial management assistance to districts and charters, especially those in statutory operating debt or through reorganization. Your bill completely ignores our very serious need to replace 40-year-old mainframe that calculates and distributes more than $6 billion in state aid and $380 million in federal aid every year to school districts. Finding employees who know how to use COBOL language is nearly impossible. The governor proposes expanding support for schools and districts that help them meet the world's best workforce requirements to engage stakeholders in continuous improvement. But your bill cuts operating funds to the department, reducing MDE's funding by 13.5%. This would eliminate 23 department employees who work hard every day to support our teachers and our schools. The impacts would be felt across the agency and across the state. Funding cuts for the award-winning regional centers of excellence that we've built under our No Child Left Behind waiver will effectively close 3 of the 6 centers and drastically impact our support for more than 118 low-performing schools throughout Minnesota, mostly in rural Minnesota. You zero out crucial support to families and schools by eliminating the School Safety and Technical Assistance Center. Our schools need the support now more than ever. 4 center staff members connected with about 200 callers last school year and are on pace to assist more this year. The majority of calls come from parents whose child or teen has been experiencing bullying. The center also delivers training and professional development on positive behavior intervention systems. They also do school site visits, conference, restorative justice training, workshops, and PBIS training. Earlier this year, more than 400 educators participated in our school safety conference, and 30 districts have participated in School Climate Institute. And just this past weekend, center staff worked with Delano and their leadership team to help them deal with the racist vandalism targeted toward a family in their community. As for policy, the governor has said he wants a clean budget bill, and there is policy in here we disagree strongly with. From ULA provisions to interference in executive administration on federal laws and Title I funding and Title II funding. Madam Chair and members, I had hoped today would be the start of a serious discussion about how we could continue our bipartisan work together that we've had over the past 6 years to improve our support for Minnesota students and schools and families. Instead, I'm here quite honestly frustrated and disappointed. But more importantly, I'm saddened for the message it sends to our kids and our families and our teachers. I oppose this bill in the strongest way. I am hopeful this committee will come back to the table with a bill that values our children and their future. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions for the Commissioner at this time? All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Let's see. Erica Moss. Actually, let's go to Superintendent Wilding first, and then... Welcome, Superintendent, and please just state your name for the record.
Hello, members of the committee. I am Superintendent Terry Wilding for the Minnesota State Academies. I want to emphasize again our discussions before the urgency of our budget proposal. At looking at the numbers that are currently in that, from last time to currently, we have been reduced. That is a great impact on our school and how we will be able to operate. Currently, we are underfunded, and we have been for a long time. With the cuts, the staff cuts, the programs, meeting the increased growth and budget of inflation, we will need to continue to cut programs if this bill passes. This may mean that we will not be able to meet our students' needs, especially with their IEP requirements, their services that are needed by those laws. Our costs will increase in the next couple of years with the benefit costs of insurance, retirement, salary and benefits increase. Through negotiations in the fall, we do not have the ability to, as you had mentioned, long-term maintenance funding. We do not have access to that. We do not have access to levies or other support systems. Because we are a state agency, we are only limited to what you allocate to us. There is no other way for us to find funding. So we depend on your support only to maintain a level of service that our kids receive. In the last few years, we have been reduced. We're trying to, with the numbers that were suggested, if we are cut more, that would mean that our kids will be suffering. The emphasis is that it is critical to increase and go back to our original numbers of 14 million instead of the 12. We need to maintain our accountability to our students and all special ed students throughout the state of Minnesota, whether that be in IEPs or other needs that we need to provide to, whether that be curriculum. We are about 91% of our annual budget is spent for salaries and benefits at this time. We are only left with 9% to deal with running our academies. That is all that is available to our students. So we do have a concern with the portion of this bill that relates to us. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you, Superintendent Wilding. And just a quick question, because I wanted to clarify, when you referred to cuts, are you referring to our budget not including the increase over base that the governor proposed?
Correct. The governor proposed a 14.26 for 18 and 14.35, I believe, for 19. And here it says 12.8 million and 12.7 million for 18-19 fiscal year. So that is a cut of 1.5. So that is below what our current needs are, and we are required to make more cuts in our programs and staffing due to that number.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to understand because, again, going back to the weeds of budget parlance, you're funded at base, but I understand that the governor did propose an increase. So I just wanted to make sure I was clear about that. Thank you.
Yes. Financial base, we have been underfunded for the last 5 or 6 years. We have had to cut 20 staff in the last 4 years, and we will lose and as well as 5 or 6 programs. So we have been getting by for a while now, but with that continued amount, we don't have much left to cut, to be honest.
Thank you, Superintendent Welling. I very much appreciate you being here.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right, Erica Moss. I'm just going to give a note to people on deck so you can be prepared to come down. Let's go Mandy Meisner and Mary Lockhart. You guys want to prepare to come down? And then, Eric, you can look at the other list of people who needed to leave. I'm sorry. Ms. Moss.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Erica Moss. I'm the Executive Director of Close Gaps by Five, a business-led nonprofit organization that's committed to using early education to close Minnesota's achievement gaps by the time children reach the age of five. I've been before the committee a couple of times. Our organization is built on the learnings and recommendations of the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, which from 2006 to 2011 raised $20 million in private funding to identify ways, cost-effective ways of preparing kids for kindergarten and addressing achievement gaps before kids get to kindergarten. Because of what that organization learned through pilots and research over those years, we've consistently advocated for policies that meet 4 evidence-based core values. Help low-income children first. These children, the children in this group are most vulnerable to gaps. They pose the highest opportunity for public return on investment, and we estimate that there are 40,000 children ages 0 to 5 in Minnesota that lack public funding for their access to early education. We believe those children should be helped early, with gaps evident as early as age 1. Research says that at-risk kids need help early and for that help to be sustained over multiple years. We also value very much giving parents flexibility to ensure that they can find options for their child's early education that meet their family's schedule or preferences, culture. Full-year access for working families. All of those things are really important for ensuring a good fit between a family and an early education program. And then finally, we have been long advocates for ensuring that the places where children are funded with taxpayer dollars, that early education best practices be in use, and we've supported the parent aware ratings as a way across settings of identifying the use of early education best practices. I'm here today to say that we support the proposal before the committee. We believe it is consistent with these research-based core values, specifically the increase in investments for early learning scholarships. Madam Chair and members, this proposal increases that investment. Doing so is consistent with the research-based values I just described. Scholarships help low-income children first, help those children early and with multiple years of help. I'd like to point out specifically the addition of a couple of categories of children who will now be able to access scholarships before age 3, children experiencing homelessness in the foster care system or in need of child protection. Scholarships do give parents flexible options, and they are tied to the parent aware ratings. I want to just emphasize that what we could do better on this front, scholarships do give parents who are working full-time a full-day, full-year option in some cases, and we support that being available. The Wilder Foundation conducted a survey for us of low-income parents last fall, and that was the number one thing on the list of parents that they wanted was access to full-day, full-year options to support work or school attendance. So again, we can do more and better on this front, but scholarships do offer that option. The proposal would also utilize the original Pathway 1 model that was piloted and proven effective by the Early Learning Foundation. We strongly support that approach. It assures that parents get help that is flexible and portable and ensures that children don't get cut off from their early learning when a family needs to move or change jobs. The Pathway 1 scholarships also maximize parent choice, so families can find programs that fit their work schedule, location, and culture. And I think it's important to note, Madam Chair, that 20% of those Pathway 1 scholarships do support children's attendance at public school-based programs. Scholarships are, an early education tool that do direct resources to a variety of types of programs. And we support all of those programs being part of a great delivery system for kids, where parents have the option of choosing the best fit for them, and where providers have the opportunity to offer those options. And then finally, Madam Chair and members, we strongly support the coordination language in this bill. Minnesota is currently investing about $400 million in early care and education programming. We applaud that commitment and that investment, and we do support increased investment, as I said. But this coordination language in the bill will really help that we're getting the most out of that existing investment. It will help us really understand where there are gaps, where there's overlap, where there are opportunities to do better. And I think to have a better coordinated system that, again, allows families to have access to a variety of options and supports a variety of providers in offering those options. So in summary, we support the proposal. We believe it's consistent with the long-held research-based core values that kind of underpin our work as an organization, and we're happy to offer our support today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moss. Ms. Lockhart Feinling, and then Ms. Meisner.
Welcome. Hi. Thank you for having me today and giving me this opportunity to testify. I'm Dr. Mary Lockhart Finling. I represent a Head Start program. I'm the director of the Head Start program, a very large rural Head Start program located in central and southwest Minnesota. We cover the areas of Wilmer, Marshall, and everywhere in between. I am here today as an advocate for Minnesota's rural at-risk children and families. I'm concerned about the language in the bill that deviates from what is currently known as Pathway 2 scholarships. The committee heard Minnesota Head Start Association testify last week on the provisions to cap funding for the most at-risk families. These concerns have not changed, as we believe it could negatively impact our highest need families. The current Pathway 2 scholarships support our students with stabilized funding and consistent programming. While the House File 890 includes key changes to the scholarship language that does not allow the Commissioner of Education to designate predetermined programs such as Head Start for scholarships. It also includes the removal of programs with waiting lists to request scholarships. The Head Start program I direct covers much of rural Minnesota. Pathway 2 scholarships are a necessity in supplementing children in my program, specifically with increased duration, lowering child-to-staff ratios, and providing much-needed mental health supports for children experiencing trauma. Because of these supplements, we are already closing the educational opportunity gap for children served in our counties. Just this fall, in the fall of 2016, when children entered our Head Start program, 50% of those children entering were behind in their age expectations, in their social-emotional development, language, and early literacy. Most alarming, though, was that 76% of our children were already behind in early mathematics. Within 5 months of our Head Start services, with the Pathway Scholarship 2 enhancements, those children were already on the pathway to closing the gap. We experienced gains across all domains of early childhood learning, Specifically, substantial gains were most notable in children's social-emotional development and children's early math skills. There was a 27.8% gain in social-emotional development and a 30.3% gain in math. That's just in 5 short months. These two early childhood domains are particularly important for discussion when closing the opportunity gap. In recent early childhood research studies, the most important area of later achievement was in early math. Additionally, children experiencing trauma are not developing social and emotional skills as their peers do. If we close, when we close the opportunity, when we close the gaps in math and early social and emotional development, we close the opportunity gap, which is the purpose of this bill. Take, for example, a child in my program, Zuri. Zuri came to our program with a history of extensive trauma in his life, did not speak English, and had been expelled from another early childhood program. He was left in the care of a relative during immigration. He exhibited severe, challenging behaviors in the Head Start classroom, hitting, screaming, biting, knocking over shelves. The teachers were able to participate through the use of Pathway 2 scholarships in regular reflective consultations with a licensed mental health provider. The mental health professional was able to observe the child in the classroom, offer assistance to both children and families, and make home visits to the family. With the mental health services provided on site, Zuri is now able to participate in Head Start classroom activities with success and is well on his way to closing his gap in development. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And Ms. Meister?
Madam Chair and Committee, thank you. My name is Mandy Meisner, and I am a Purpich Center for Arts Education graduate. I was part of the third graduating class of 1993. At the time, music had become very important to me. Yes, I loved it and dedicated much time to it, but beyond that, I yearned for more. More challenge, more opportunity, more understanding. I wanted so much more, but I could not describe most of it if you asked me. I only knew that there was a whole world that eluded me that I wished to be in it. In my family, I was the only one who could read music for 3 generations. I lived in a middle-class community attending a public school whose arts programs were poorly funded. When I heard about Purpich, applied and auditioned, then later accepted, I pinned my hopes that this was entry into the world of art that eluded me. And it was. My 2 years there shaped who I am today more than any other experience. Here, I was offered more and then some. Here, I grew as a musician. More than that, I was taught what it meant to be a musician and how to value all art forms. Here, I received good grades in my core academics. More than that, I learned independent thinking to examine information with a critical lens and how to problem solve creatively. Here, I made good friendships. More than that, I built relationships across the spectrum of geography, economic status, worldviews, art discipline, and gender. I know at the time, the building and the programming was in its infancy. I never saw the blood, sweat, and tears of the professionals who taught me. I only saw the heart and possibility of their work. This gave me heart and possibility in all things for the rest of my life. There is really only one thing that has been a hindrance to my status as a Purpich graduate. The one question in general society that gauges our success or failure. Do I make a successful living in the arts? No, I do not. To this I say, I understand the reasoning of this measurement. This is, after all, an arts high school. To an outsider, a stakeholder, or a primary decision maker, it is logical criteria. The problem with this question and its answer is that it only addresses mainstream arts success. What I am talking about is arts education. An arts education, which we all receive regardless of our choice of industry, gave us the gift of vital intangibles that we employ in business and family and community. The in-depth and whole education we received taught us the history, effects, techniques, and beauty that is art. Our arts education allows us to appreciate the hidden details in life that can be applied beyond a painting, or book, or ballet, or symphony concert.
And Ms. Meisner, if you could wrap up, please.
Almost done, thank you. We can see art in the intellectual pursuit it is. We can see the creativity in the boardroom where others cannot. The direct results of my time and education at Purpich have allowed me to be a productive adult in creative, intelligent, and thoughtful ways that I would not be able to had I not went here. I am a better person because I went here. I am more civic-minded, more collaborative, more confident, with more skills to offer in the workplace. Admittedly, these attributes that I live out and am sought after for in community aren't as quantifiable as perhaps you would like. Yet I and over 4,000 others am living proof of what success of having an arts education at the Purpich Center looks like. Our past leadership has been frustrating, disappointing, and worrisome to witness. I appreciate the examination and understand your position for doing so. Today, I am very optimistic that Purpich will regain the strong and efficient reputation it once had with this new leadership. This school should remain open to continue its legacy of producing more artists, more leaders, more public servants, more people who will become their best selves. Because the world needs more of us. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Ms. Meisner.
Next, where are we going?
Mr. Unowski, Superintendent, Richfield Schools.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Steve Unowski, Superintendent of Richfield Public Schools, a suburban first-tier district with 4,400 students and 64% of our students in poverty. I also want to point out that we have 140 of our students in a four-year-old program and additional students in our three-year-old program, both of which are brand new and launched due to voluntary pre-K and pathway scholarships. This year, our graduation rates jumped above the state average. And we are doing what many people would be very proud of. Our Caucasian students are 3% above the state in their graduation. Our Latino students are 7% above the state in graduation. And our African-American children are 15% above the state in graduation. Our MCA scores in reading and math have gone up in each of the last 2 years, and we've made progress in terms of the numbers of students proficient when compared to the state average. Basically, we're getting it done. We're also creative. We've added for next year, launching a seven-period day in our high school, adding 20 instructional minutes to our school day without any increase in funding whatsoever. We have also done this despite receiving approximately $500 per student in referendum levy funds, less than any of our neighboring districts. So we are finding ways, given the financial package, to deliver a product that is closing the achievement gap for our students. That brings us to the current education omnibus bill at 1.5% on the formula, which for a 4,400 student district gives us about $400,000. Subtracting out fixed costs, gasoline, heat, buses, buildings, costs us approximately $500,000, which means that already there is, subtracting fixed costs, a $100,000 reduction that will actually go to students and classrooms based on the current education omnibus bill. 1.5% delinked to formula in Richfield Public Schools means that there is less in our classrooms, there are less teachers for our students, and there will be no pre-K programming in Richfield Public Schools, making us getting the job done that we all look to do in the state of Minnesota much more difficult. Thank you very much, committee.
Thank you, Mr. Udowski. Representative Selkum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you feel the enthusiasm that my superintendent offers? He also, recently they opened medical services for the students, which work with also mental health services. It's an amazing program that he oversees and has worked to start for the kids in Richfield, who are high-need kids, by and large.
Thank you. One question, because I wrote this down. I want to make sure I understood it right. Did you say you have only $500 per levy, or $500 per child in a levy?
No, we are $500 less than any of our surrounding neighboring districts.
Thank you. I didn't think I wrote that down correctly.
Since I didn't get the time sign to back up Ms. Slocum, we actually got a free partnership that does provide free medical services to our students, both the 21 in the city of Richfield, free mental health services. We actually have a food shelf and a clothing shelf and provide all of those services free of charge. So, again, doing things off of the financial spectrum completely.
Thank you. All right. So, Mr. Santa. All right. And then on deck, Carol Miller, Hennepin County. Okay. And then after Ms. Miller, we'll go to Chris Belmont. All right. Mr. Santa.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Tony Sani. I'm the CEO of the Sani Foundation, and we built a program on common sense and following the rules, and so I'm going to follow the rules and keep it short. I want to thank you for recognizing the important work that we've been doing as a result of the funding you provided us last year. We understand and appreciate the commitment and your vision for expanding our program to other school sites, so more students can be empowered and overcome academic and behavior barriers. While the current funding levels will create a challenge for the current schools we're in, we look forward to working with legislation and other community stakeholders in our efforts to continue to provide opportunities not only for our existing schools, but expanding the Dreamland program as well. I promise we will always put students first, and we will come back with the daily asphalt to back it up. Thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Santa. Appreciate your brevity. All right, Ms. Miller. And then Mr. Belmont, you're on deck. All right.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carol Miller. I'm an area manager with Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. We are here to support the new language in Article 8, beginning on page 108, which expands the early learning scholarship criteria, age, and funding for very high needs young children, specifically those who are involved in child protection, those in foster care, and those who are homeless across ages birth to five. Over the past 3 years, I've worked on an internal initiative to connect more of our highest needs young children with high-quality early care and education. The Hennepin County Board chose to invest local dollars in increased access to high-quality programs for county-involved young children to boost their early development and improve school readiness. This initiative came out of a study that we did on high school graduation and other educational outcomes for our older county-involved children, and we discovered that most of them had been known to us much younger, and the decision was made to focus additional services on the younger age children. Initially, our internal scholarship program served a variety of high-need situations, including all of those in Article 8. However, by year two, we were experiencing the same jump in child protection investigations and foster care placements that have happened around the state. We've had to limit our funds to only cover high-quality child care for foster children, birth to five, and only for the time they are in placement, limiting child stability and programs, which also greatly concerns us. 43% of our foster children are birth to five, and a large proportion of our open child protection children are as well. Currently, we have over 600 foster children, at least half under the age of three. We have been able to place, currently we're funding about 200 of those foster children with county money and only while they're in foster care. We have in the last year been able to assist foster parents, about 100 of them, to apply for state early learning scholarships for 3 and 4 year olds, and we are very grateful for those. We know that these high needs children These children need the high-quality services in education settings because we screen them. We find that they are behind on their developmental benchmarks, even the very youngest ones. Many also fail our very reliable social-emotional screening. I'll finish by saying that we have had many... we've had much feedback from the program serving the children as well as our foster parents about how the children have blossomed, come out of their shells, and how they are thriving and learning. We would like to support the expanded scholarship language in Article 8, addressing those highest needs children, removing the age and funding caps, and the supports that are needed to sustain enrollment for children over longer periods of time. Thank you for your attention, and thank you for including this element in your bill.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. All right, Mr. Belmont. And then After Mr. Belmont, we'll go to Bill Jones or Ann Kay with Rock and Reed. Mr. Belmont.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Belmont. I'm a school psychologist serving Sartell Middle School and Holdingford Elementary in the St. Cloud area. Over the course of my 15 years serving students, I have seen a dramatic increase in the need for support services as we've moved from an outdated wait-to-fail model to a more modern prevention model using multi-tiered systems of support. Though this model requires more of an investment in support services on the front end, the payoff is the much larger amounts of money saved by preventing children from needing special education services in the long term. We continue to see significant increases for mental health needs as well in our schools. In light of recent research on the long-term impacts of childhood trauma, now more than ever, we need to focus on educating from a mental health perspective. I'm here today to ask for a greater support of mental health service providers in education. I personally serve over 1,800 students with a recommended ratio of 1 to 500. Our school counselors serve over twice the recommended ratio of 1 to 250. Our school social workers are generally operating at four times the recommended ratios of 1 to 250. The negative impacts on classrooms and teachers for students not having mental health needs matter immeasurable. I'm disappointed that this bill does not include any funding at all for our student support services. We know how great the need is. I urge you, as this bill moves forward, to include funding for these vital services in our schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Belmont. And next up, Mr. Jones, Ms. Kay.
Madam Chair and Representative, I want to thank you for allowing us to come in today. My name is Bill Jones, along with my partner, Ann Kay. We co-founded the Rock and Read Project. Our mission is helping children read at grade level through singing. And I did make Ann promise before we came today that she would not make you stand and sing, which she normally does. But we appreciate you including funding in House Bill 2466. We did receive a $100,000 grant this last year, which we used in four schools. And I'm putting together a budget now based on a $600,000 grant that the Senate has recommended. And I am not positive of the amount that's in the bill, but I understand it's $500,000 possibly, and so we will build the grant accordingly. But I want to have Ann just very briefly tell you about the results from last year's bill.
Since we've got Ann Kay, co-founder of the Rock and Read Project, Madam Chair and Representatives, since we already talked to you a little bit about it, just want to remind you that our early gains of the fall over just the fall period were in 7.5 to 14 hours. The children in the Rock and Read Project in four schools made one half-year gain in reading and double the gain of the children who are not singing in the Rock and Read Project, but struggling readers. So we're looking very much forward to seeing the MCA comparisons, student by student. and we thank you so much for including another bill for the next 2 years of funding.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
All right, so let's see. Ms. Reinick? I had you on my list to one of the people that needs to leave early, and I think I got through all the ones they raised their hand except for Purpose, and I got you. We'll get you in here in before 2:45. Ms. Reinick.
Hi, Chair Luna and members. My name is Amanda Reinick, and I'm a pre-K teacher with a birth through sixth grade teaching license. I worked in two different West Metro school districts. I'm here to share a story of one of my kids to illustrate why school-based pre-K is necessary for children in the state of Minnesota, regardless of their family's income. My story today is of a young girl who was very anxious and angered easily. During her anger outbursts, she would scream, kick over chairs, and pull materials off shelves. I met with my classroom team, an early childhood social worker, and the child's parents to develop an education plan for the year. It included group discussions with classmates focused on healthy and unhealthy ways to handle big feelings, anger, fear, etc. By the end of the school year, the young girl's outbursts were a rare occurrence. With her parents' permission, the kindergarten teachers in my building were given information about my student that included interventions that have worked to help calm the child. The child left my classroom with a large group of friends, a strong understanding of letters and number sense, and an ability to transition through a school day with very little, if any, teacher assistance. Goals for all my students. Like most of the families in my program, this child's family would not qualify for scholarships. Without our pre-K program, this child would not have had a seamless transition into kindergarten. My immediate access to early childhood social workers and kindergarten teachers played an integral part in the child's success at my school. Access to a quality pre-K program that includes a properly trained licensed teacher who will provide students with academic and social tools for a seamless transition to kindergarten should be a goal for all Minnesota children, regardless of family income. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rennick. All right, so now let's go to Rachel Berger. And on deck will be Madeline Edison.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity. I'll keep this short, as promised. I'm from Decoding Dyslexia, Minnesota. We're a grassroots parents advocacy group concerned with the educational limitations for students with dyslexia within our public schools. We've been working on addressing the educational inequities for students who struggle with dyslexia for a number of years, and we've got a lot of great support from many of you, especially this year on the House side. I'm here because I'm concerned that the language in the House omnibus bill deviates from the language that was introduced and gained support of so many of you. The omnibus doesn't include currently the provision that would enable teachers needed professional development. We know from a survey last year, which was collaborated by the teachers' union, that 74% of our teachers have had no training in dyslexia. This is a disability that affects 17 to 20% of our population's ability to learn to read. 80% of teachers responded that they have students receiving intervention, and those students weren't responding to the intervention, teachers didn't know what to do next. And 94% of them stated that they wanted more training in dyslexia. We've been careful in our advocacy not to propose unfunded mandates. We have data that supports the need for both students and teachers and legislators that have pledged support for our bill. There's 50 states involved in the Decoding Dyslexia mission. I thought it would be important to note that we are one of only 11 states that don't have meaningful dyslexia legislation on the books currently. Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana all have dyslexia laws that are making impact to their struggling readers. We're faced with a concerning grade level reading proficiency rate.
Currently, we spend a lot of dollars on intervention programs. I'm concerned that we're not able currently to spend money on professional development for teachers who are asking for it, who want it to benefit their students. I'm asking and encouraging that you include the provision as it was introduced that would enable teachers to receive professional development. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Berger. Ms. Edison?
All right, and on deck will be, I have several representatives, Violeta Espinosa from the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs, Cade Wallace, Tao Zhong, and Dennis Olson. So you'll be up next. I'm sorry, Ms. Edison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Madeline Edison, and I am the Executive Director of Educators for Excellence Minnesota, which is a nonprofit organization that works with 1,800 teachers across the metro area on issues that will improve student outcomes and elevate the teaching profession. And I'm here to address specifically the Collaborative Urban Educator, or CUE, program provisions on page 70 of the budget. And I'd like to thank you for your support for increased funding, competition, and accountability for the programs in the Q program, and to call on you to consider additional funding for this program. So this bill opens up the Q fund to provide additional programs beyond the four that are identified in statute with the opportunity to apply for funding. This funding is directed towards increasing the quality and diversity of teacher preparation programs. And it's important that we provide the opportunity for more universities and teacher preparation programs to benefit from this program, because there are some really great traditional and non-conventional preparation programs out there that are doing great work training teachers, future teachers of color. And this amendment that you have proposed includes some more outcome-based criteria that will ensure that the investments that we're putting on the table are going to programs that are really doing this work well. So thank you for hearing the need to grow this program and its accountability. And while I support the language around the accountability and opening up to more programs, I'm also calling for an increased investment in this program. So currently on the table, there is $220,000 that's eligible to be shared across any new programs that would apply to benefit from the competitive pool. And I would anticipate this would result in one or two additional programs being able to meaningfully benefit and serve more teachers of color without diluting the impact of this funding. So if we bring this down to the student or the teacher candidate level, and when you look at one of the highest performing programs that currently exists in the Q Fund, Augsburg University, they were able to train 24 teachers of color with $200,000 that's provided to their institution. So that's an example of the number of students or teachers that we would anticipate benefiting from this additional $220,000. So I would urge you to increase this funding to $500,000 or more for the competitive pool to make sure that we have a meaningful injection of resources, incentivizing innovation in traditional teacher prep programs and spurring new alternative programs to emerge, especially during this critical time when we know that rural and urban communities are facing shortfalls in hiring teachers and not able to fill all their positions. We think now is the time to make sure that our teacher preparation programs have the support to do that well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Edison. All right. Violeta Espinosa. Wallace. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Violeta Hernandez Espinosa, and I'm the Education Legislative Liaison for the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. Before I read a joint statement from the three ethnic councils and the Indian Affairs Council, I would like my colleagues to introduce themselves first.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Tu Zhang, and I'm the Legislative Liaison with the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Cade Wallace, the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage.
Madam Chair, members,
Again, also part of this joint statement is the Indian Affairs Council, who was unable to have a representative today, but they are a part of this joint statement. As state agencies, we are charged with advising and informing you, state lawmakers, on issues and related legislation that more directly impact our respective communities, communities which collectively represent 19% of the state's population and 31% of the state's student body. In analyzing House File 890, we are heartened to see that the teacher shortage from underrepresented racial and ethnic groups received a place in your committee's priorities, including the teacher shortage loan forgiveness programs, 1 year of appropriation, continued funding of Grow Your Own programs, and an allocation for competitive grants to expand the collaborative urban educator program. We thank the chair and the committee for making this issue a priority. The severe shortage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers and the enduring achievement gaps, which place Minnesota in the lowest levels of student achievement in the nation by various indicators for communities of color and American Indian, are all of our council's main priorities. These two issues are interrelated. Research has shown that teachers of color can improve standardized test scores, attendance, retention, advanced level course enrollment, graduation rates, and college going rates for students of color in particular. As such, we urge you to do more, as these programs and appropriations will not be enough to raise the percentage of teachers from these underrepresented communities, which is only 4.2%, and will likely remain in the 4% range with this bill. We understand the difficulty of meeting target budgets, but as further appropriations and programs are discussed in the upcoming conference committees, we look forward to meeting with committee members and chair in answering questions on any matters relating to these issues. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for being here. So, Ms. Lewandowski, superintendent, is she here? Did she just go out of the room? Oh, okay. We can move on to somebody else, and then not to worry. So let's go with, Claire Luger, special education teacher from Forest Lake. Okay. You'll be next. Ms. Lewandowski, you'll be next. So welcome, Ms. Luger.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I genuinely appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak here today. My name is Claire Luger, and I'm a special education teacher in the Forest Lake School District. I teach students with significant needs who are frequently identified as at risk. One of my students came in yesterday without a coat or hat. So while we tried to find a set, at least for the day, another student, not having taken his meds that morning, lost his temper and began lashing out physically and as well as verbally. See, our district is no longer able to provide FIED every day due to budget cuts, and he was upset with that. As all of this was going on, a third student sheepishly handed me the classwork she had gone home with. Every question was blank. Her explanation was that Dad had been watching TV that all night, and Mom was watching videos. I glanced over the files of paperwork on my desk that I'd intended to do during that time, and realized that this was not the time that it was going to happen. I am in the business of preparing small, frequently unpredictable human beings to be healthy and participate meaningfully in the real world once the school walls go away. In order for that to happen, I need this committee to use the power it has with regards to mandates and funding. Bluntly, our kids need more. As a special education teacher and a parent of a student who has received special education services, I am concerned. We are not only responsible for providing individualized instruction and services to support students, but also for creating the legal documents that support those services and facilitating the entire process with administration, school staff, family members, and outside agencies. Districts, teachers, and paraprofessionals need more support from the legislature. We need equitable funding for all districts and mandates that allows teachers to do their job, paperwork as well as teaching. We live in a state that has some of the highest educational standards in the country, and very proudly so. And we saw outcomes improve last year as a result. We need you to ensure that mandates are appropriately funded so that we have the resources and the ability to successfully prepare those small human beings for the world outside once the school walls come down. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Liger. We appreciate you being here. Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandra Lewandowski, and I'm the superintendent of Intermediate District 287, and I'm also here today representing the superintendents in Intermediate 916, 917, and 288. I want to convey my deep gratitude for the inclusion of the Intermediate School District Mental Health Innovation Grant Program in the omnibus bill. The language and appropriation, as indicated in this bill, would provide a transformation in how education and mental health services are provided to the very highest need and often most aggressive students in the public school system. Our vision is for a therapeutic teaching model where therapy and education are equally embedded in the classroom in order to move students forward to not only educational success, but behavioral success. But in addition to the gratitude from the intermediate superintendents, I'd like to express my gratitude from the children and parents who may never know how these services came to be. For hundreds of such children and their families, this indeed would be transformational the rest of their lives. I thank you for the very difficult work you do each and every day.
Thank you very much, Superintendent. Okay, so Mr. Vanderkoy and Ms. Orpin. All right, I'm going to do one last notice. If there's anyone that's come from a distance or anyone who's not a paid lobbyist, not that we don't appreciate you, but who's not being paid to be here, who wishes to testify, and then we may go a little bit over, maybe till 3 o'clock if we can, and we'll see where we're at with our list at that time. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Ben Vanderkoy. I'm the chair of the Perkins Center for the Arts Board of Directors. And I'm here today. I've been here many times. But to just reaffirm that we hope that you keep the Perkins Center for the Arts in existence. As you all know, we went through a difficult audit. We are taking steps to embrace the changes and make the changes that need to be made. So we think we deserve a chance to at least keep the school and outreach together. On the other hand, we hope you can accelerate the transfer of Crosswinds. We think that that was a huge mistake for us to operate that school. And we have a proposal from St. Paul Public Schools that we think makes a lot of sense for students, and the faculty, and for the program in the East Metro. So I'm just here today to remind you again that we hope that you'll help us transfer Crosswinds as quickly as possible, and hopefully by the end of this fiscal year. And then also that you'll allow Perkins to remain for the foreseeable future, as long as we keep making the changes which we promised to make. And so with that, I can turn this over, unless there are questions, to the Vice Chair of the Board, who also would like to talk.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Julie Workman, and I'm Vice Chair of the Perkins Center for Arts Education Board of Directors. The Commissioner of Education mentioned earlier public school choice and the opportunities that parents and students have to best meet their needs through choice schools in the state of Minnesota. The Perkins Arts High School is another choice school, which is intended to serve high-achieving, high-potential students in the arts, visual, dance, theater, music. The difference between this particular choice high school and others is that it has a residential component, especially important for outstate students who are often not having their needs met in their local school district. One component of the arts outreach program supports all arts education and teacher training. The Perkins staff have been instrumental in contributing to national and state standards in arts education. They also provide a resource in curriculum planning. Ben has already mentioned the audit findings. We have developed a corrective action plan, which includes each finding from the audit, the person who is responsible for corrective action in the audit, a timeline, and then finally actions taken. I am very sure that this board of directors will be able to meet the challenges of the audit and we hope that you will be seriously considering the continuation of the Purpich Center for Arts Education. Thank you.
Thank you very much. One quick question. Could you tell me how many students from outstate that you have right now that are residential students?
I believe it's about 30% of the campus, which would translate into roughly 70, I believe.
Okay. Thank you. All right, any other questions? All right, not seeing any questions right now, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's do that. So let's do Kristen, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Stunkel? Thank you for helping me. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Loon, members of the committee, I am Kristen Stunkel, Director of Community Education for Columbia Heights Public Schools. This afternoon, I am representing the Minnesota Community Education Association. There are many items in this bill that have implications for community education programs that serve Minnesotans in every community throughout the state. We have testified about many of these areas over the past several weeks. Those concerns have deepened as we believe this bill will have negative impacts on the families we serve, especially our highest need families. While we appreciate the proposed increase in school readiness funding, we believe it will not offset the elimination of other funding streams in the bill. Given the significant changes in this bill, we feel concerned about how this committee sees the role and value of school-based preschool programs. More specifically today, we are here to testify against the elimination of the voluntary pre-kindergarten program. Voluntary pre-kindergarten was established to offer parents a choice in free, high-quality preschool and to prepare four-year-olds in the greatest poverty for success in kindergarten. We are sure that your committee hasn't abandoned the conviction that these young scholars deserve the best start in their academic development. Columbia Heights Public Schools received funding to serve 180 four-year-olds in our voluntary pre-K program at each of our elementary schools. Every school in our district has over 75% free and reduced lunch rate. In fact, we're the highest poverty district in the metro area. And with voluntary pre-kindergarten, we are serving exactly the students who would fall into the achievement gap before kindergarten even begins. For families in our district and other districts receiving voluntary pre-K, these are the benefits. Free kindergarten pre-kindergarten programming for four-year-olds, alignment to curriculum, instruction, and assessment with kindergarten, classrooms integrated with special education and English language learning services, transportation to school, participation in the breakfast and lunch program, access to school social workers and other school-based programs for students and families, coordination with local child care providers for wraparound services, and with county programs to enroll students experiencing homelessness or in the foster care program. The voluntary pre-K is now a grade, like all the others in our school, and this bill would eliminate a grade. I understand that there is some increase in school readiness funding, but that would not equal the loss of voluntary pre-K funding. I am sure you can appreciate the disruption that eliminating voluntary pre-K would cause to districts that have set up voluntary pre-kindergarten classrooms, hired highly trained staff, and enrolled students. The elimination of voluntary pre-kindergarten would mean, in our district and others, the closing of classrooms and preparing fewer students for kindergarten success. The development of our young Minnesota scholars and of our future workforce is based on access to high-quality education. Please support the continuation of voluntary pre-kindergarten, an important program in supporting Minnesota families and communities. Thank you for your time and consideration.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Stunkel. One question I've been trying to get my arms around. So you mentioned you have 180 students in the VPK program.
That's
Columbia
correct.
Heights. Were any of those students receiving services through any of the programs, other programs that you operate, school readiness or others, or some other state-funded early education program?
Thank you for that question. Prior to receiving the voluntary pre-kindergarten program, we were able to serve 120 students. We increased our programming. We increased to a full-day classroom. Our full-day classroom only serves students who qualify for free and reduced lunch. Our other classrooms, all of them serve at least 75% of the students are free and reduced lunch eligible. But the other factor is that now integrated into the K-12 system, we're able to access so many of the services in the schools that
that we weren't able to access when it was part of our early childhood program. So access to the social workers, access to the supports within the schools. It's truly become another grade in the school system with all of the supports and integration that that entails.
Okay. And so like in your school readiness programs or other, maybe we call it preschool in some of the other districts, even though we call it school readiness here, do those students have access to any social worker services or any other of those special services you mentioned?
Prior to having the funding with voluntary pre-kindergarten, we did not have adequate funding in order to have access to the social workers. The social workers were there for K-12, not for early childhood, and we didn't have additional funds to hire more social workers. We've worked with other community organizations to try to provide some of the supports, but the supports that we have access to as part of the K-12 system has greatly expanded. And for our high poverty district, we were charging $114 for half-day programs for a full month. Only 25% of our families could even pay $114 for a month's worth of pre-K. So we can't backfill with fees like some other districts can.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Westra, she's here.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm here today to thank you on behalf of my daughter Claire, who you met last week, and all the other students impacted across the state, not only in Fulda but in the other districts, for the language you've added regarding PSEO and allowing students to be in the building. I'm a parent in the Fulda district, and I really appreciate this language. I still hold out hope that they will perhaps rescind this policy and allow the students to be in the building yet this year. And the brain drain is a real problem in rural Minnesota. And so when we put in policies like this that don't encourage our students to be part of their school and part of their community, their link to want to come back is really damaged. And that concerns me, not only in our district, but across the rural communities in our area. So I appreciate your willingness to step in with language that will stop these types of policies. There are many times when doing the right thing has a steep financial cost. This is not one of those times. And so I'm not here to ask for money, so that might be something that's a positive for the day. It costs very little to allow students to stay in a building that's already open during the school day, and it costs very little to have them sit into an existing study hall or sit in a chair in the library and do their work. So I wanted to thank you again, especially Madam Chair, for sponsoring that legislation, Representative Erickson, for having it heard the first time. And so thank you so much for your work on the behalf of the kids.
Thank you very much, Ms. Westra. Let's go to Joshua Crossan and Brandy Burris Gallagher at Allies. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joshua Crossan, and I'm with Ed Allies, which is an education advocacy nonprofit that works to improve public education for each and every kid here in Minnesota. At Ed Allies, we promote three basic pillars that would drastically improve our public education system. One, resources should be distributed equitably with a preference to our most underserved kids. Two, schools should be rigorous and relevant both academically and culturally. And three, teachers and school leaders should be highly effective, well-resourced, and well-trained. Many of the provisions in the chair's bill meet these pillars. First element we'd like to point out is a focus on data disaggregation. When it comes to resources being equitably distributed and schools meeting the cultural needs of students, we first need to understand who our students are and how they're doing. I'd like to thank the chair for your commitment to the disaggregation of student data. Provisions in this bill work to help schools and districts implement the law and, most importantly, work well for our students. We also know that teachers are the most important in-school factor to student achievement, which is why we need the best teachers, especially with our most underserved kids. The teacher shortage crisis across the state is proving devastating for students, especially shortages in the STEM, career and technical education fields, and especially among our teachers of color. So to address these shortages, investments in innovative and alternative pathways to the classroom is key to recruiting more and more diverse educators. We support the provisions in this bill that provide targeted investments in alternative and unconventional teacher preparation programs. We also support the teacher shortage loan forgiveness program to recruit and retain educators. As mentioned in teacher shortages, we're also focusing on a bizarre public education system law where we know that the kids with the most help, namely our kids of color, low-income kids, and kids with disabilities, are often placed with the least experienced educators. Because of our state's laws, districts are forced to lay teachers off in our poor schools and more of them, which further disrupts their learning, the learning of our most underserved kids. We support provisions in this bill that protect the interests of our most underserved students by allowing schools and districts to keep the best teachers in the classroom of our most vulnerable students. And lastly, I thank the chair for her advocacy on increasing school funding and encourage the chair to continue to advocate for larger investments for our kids. That said, we know spending more does not automatically improve our system alone. We must also couple that with spending more wisely. And with any amount of funds, we must give preference, continue to give preference to our most underserved students. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Brandy Burris-Gallagher. I'm also a policy director at Ed Allies. This afternoon, I'd like to offer some thoughts on the early learning portions of the chair's bill as amended. One of our top priorities this session has been an ask to the legislature to both prioritize and streamline high-quality early learning for low-income families. Backed by research, we believe Minnesota can make the biggest impact in early learning by pursuing three goals. Number one, funding should be need-conscious and prioritized to fully fund programs for families living in or near poverty. Number two, programming should be high-quality. The state's investment should support proven, successful programs that we know use best practices and meet learners' diverse needs. Number three, families should have choice. Parents should have the power to choose the right program for their child, whether in-home, center-based, or school-based. With that said, it is heartening to see some of the ways that this bill, as amended, moves the state in this direction. And I'd like to highlight those areas quickly. First, we'd like to thank the chair for new investments in school readiness, which would extend these critical early learning dollars to our state's public charter schools and the students that they serve. Second, we would like to thank the chair for investments into the state's early learning scholarship program, a program we know meets the three goals I discussed earlier and would add new seats for students. Finally, we would like to thank the chair for starting a conversation about how we might coordinate early learning dollars to maximize the impact this investment has on our youngest learners. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go, Kay Ying Yang, Coalition of Asian American Leaders. And Barte Wahi. After that. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Loon and members of the committee. I am Kai Ying Yang, Policy Director of the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. CAL is a network of nearly 600 individual leaders representing all sectors. We believe our democracy thrives when all communities are visible, included, and fully engaged in key systemic decisions that impact our lives. I'm here to thank you, Chair Loon, and the committee for including House File 2258 in the omnibus bill. We appreciate your thoughtful consideration to amend the bill to mirror Representative Erickson's education bill, specifically related to data desegregation. We work closely with our partners at Allies, MDE, and St. Paul School District to develop this agreed-upon language, and we all support these provisions. As you are well aware, and as stated in the bill, the intent of this bill is to disaggregate student data to reveal disparities for students from underserved and underrepresented groups or communities. Whereas schools, districts, communities, and the state are working to understand how data collection and data interpretation can inform policies to understand and improve education opportunities for specific student groups. As a grassroots community advocacy organization, we have successfully gathered 70 organizations, parents and educators who have endorsed the data desegregation bill. And I didn't bring enough copies, but if you look here, we have all the list of the organizations in the back. I hope that she was disseminated. For nearly 20 years, I have been working with other civil rights organizations to advocate for data desegregation nationally. For Asian Minnesotans, ensuring that our inclusion and equity discussions means having the ability to see and understand more nuanced data. When we are lumped into the aggregate category of Asians, our community's disparities become hidden. Incomplete data leads to misunderstandings about who Asian Americans are and who other ethnic groups are, what unique needs exist, and what community assets may be uplifted to solve community challenges. This is a disservice to these communities, as the most vulnerable are left behind, resources are wasted, and assets go unrecognized and unappreciated. Data desegregation should be conducted and supported to include accurate and good information about diverse groups to achieve educational equity in Minnesota. Thank you for your attention and support.
Thank you very much, Ms. Yang. We appreciate you being here. Thank you. All right. Ms. Wahi.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barty Wahi, and I'm the Executive Director of the Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. CDF Minnesota focuses its attention on the needs of children who face a steeper ladder to success, including children in living in families who can't afford to meet basic needs, the needs of children of color and American Indian children. Children's Defense Fund supports the ability of parents to decide the best early learning opportunity for their child. We believe a robust system of early learning includes all of the options that currently exist for children, including Head Start, center-based child care, voluntary pre-K, scholarship, both Pathway 1 and Pathway 2, school readiness programs, and licensed family child care. We're pleased to see that some of these funding streams and models are represented in the bill. However, we urge you to remember that despite significant gains in early learning and early childhood investments over the past 10 years, there's still much work to do. And this mix of funding and program models supports the diversity of our communities, both cultural and geographic. Cuts to these funding streams and programs limit a parent's ability to meet their child's needs. And we know that a number of children in our community continue to remain unserved. In addition to our support of robust funding for early learning and education, we're here to testify specifically on the eligibility change that is listed in Section 8, Subdivision 4, which is on page 110 of the omnibus bill. Currently, the eligibility requirement for receipt of early learning scholarship for programs is that as of July 1, 2016, all programs accepting early learning scholarships must be 3 or 4 star rated through the quality rating system Parent Aware. The shift that is proposed in the legislation would push this back to July 1, 2020. This would allow early learning programs to continue on their pathway to star ratings and would support our 1 and 2 star rated programs. It would also really allow scholarship parent recipients more choice for providers to meet their needs. For parents of color, American Indian parents, and parents living in Greater Minnesota, this would allow their use of scholarship with a broader group of providers that could meet their needs. It would also, this extension would also really allow funds and resources into communities that are already experiencing critical shortages for early learning. And finally, this pushback would allow programs who've demonstrated a commitment to the rating system and to quality, as it is defined by that system, a strategy and a pathway to move forward. Thank you so much for your commitment to children, and I really appreciate the opportunity to testify today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Tom Citron-Heisen, Literacy Action Network. And then to Mr. Hennis with the University of St. Thomas after that.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is actually Scott Helland. Tom is not able to be with us today.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. What was your name?
Scott Helland.
Scott Helland. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm representing Literacy Action Network and MCA, Minnesota Community Education Association. We came to you with a proposal to increase adult basic education funding, which increases the contact hour funding for all CBOs, and it increases the overall consortium funding to address the shortfall in federal funding, providing funding for such things as enhanced technology infrastructure of students, increased development of distance learning, enhanced wraparound support services for learners. I want to thank Representative Peterson for introducing this bill. Minnesota is currently in the early stages of a growing labor shortage with over 100,000 unfilled jobs at present and many more vacancies forecast as baby boomers retire. Economists agree that the only way to fill the labor gap is to train and educate existing members of the labor force, which is exactly what adult basic education does. ABE programs statewide are being asked to develop significant new career pathways training, the most resource-intensive of all ABE services, with declining and diminished resources. Today, rather than an opportunity to speak to increasing resources, we are opposing reductions in existing funding. We are deeply concerned over the proposed cut in the ABE growth factor from 3% to 1% annually. This will mean a potential loss of over $2 million per year in funds desperately needed to fulfill the statutory responsibilities of ABE to help educate over 65,000 lower-skilled Minnesotans, preparing them for employment and higher education each year. Even with the current growth factor, the contact hour rate has been virtually unchanged since 2001, $5.72 per hour then, $5.86. Now, during these years, the cumulative inflation rate totaled more than 36%. During these same years, ABE has been asked to take on ever-increasing responsibilities, especially in providing more and more employment skills, training to prepare people for the growing labor shortage, career pathways ranging from accounting support to IT, commercial driver's license, construction, healthcare, automotive, and many others have been developed in response to employer needs. These types of services are intensive and expensive to provide. They require smaller classes, intensive curricula, development instruction, development of community partnerships with employers and others. Current resources are already inadequate. In addition to career pathways, ABE services include GED, adult high school diploma, English as a second language, basic skills enhancement, family literacy, civic citizenship, distance learning, and digital literacy. Our capacity to provide each and all of these will be negatively affected by any decrease in funding. The number of ABE teachers who are part-time has grown from two-thirds to three-fourths in recent years, largely due to cuts. Adding a cut to current ABE funding will diminish our ongoing ability to meet employer needs. Many of those who serve are victims of the achievement gap in K-12, and our ability to offer the same or increased levels of services to this group will lessen over time. We respectfully ask that the full 3% ABE growth rate be restored.
Thank you, Mr. Helen. Mr. Hinz.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Doug Hennis. I'm Vice President for Government Relations at the University of St. Thomas. I'm speaking today on behalf of St. Thomas and other teacher of color programs that you have funded through Q appropriations, Q standing for Collaborative Urban Educator Programs. For starters, we want to express our gratitude that House File 890 proposes to maintain funding in FY 18 and 19 for our programs. With the financial support from the legislature, our 4Q programs have collectively educated approximately 25% of the 2,500 teachers of color in Minnesota public schools today. St. Thomas alone has educated 437 teachers through the Q program since 1992, and 48 more teachers will join the workforce this fall. We do have one concern with the provision at the top of page 71. Which says that for fiscal year 2020 and later, all Q grants must be awarded through a competitive grant program. We have strong established programs that have proven over the last 25 years that they can effectively recruit, educate, and mentor teachers of color. We also have high retention rates and provided an excellent return on the state's investment. We urge the committee to keep the funding that works and use additional competitive grant funds to maximize the number of new programs that can begin to receive funding. We support the concept of a competitive grant process because it will help new and innovative programs that also want to help increase the number of teachers of color. Our four institutions today have students enrolled at this time, and we are actively recruiting for future cohorts. Our concern is that the competitive process would cast uncertainty and delay a timely start to our programs. At St. Thomas, for example, we must start our CUE program by September 1st in order for students to have enough time to take required courses and then be placed in teaching positions in school districts within 2 years. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gumnett? And after Mr. Gumnett, we'll go to Valerie Doslin. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Gumnett. I'm the CEO of People Serving People, the largest and most comprehensive shelter for children and their families experiencing homelessness. Also today, I'm speaking on behalf of Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota, and I'm a member of the Mini Minds Coalition. I want to thank the Chair for her work on this bill, especially with the challenging budget targets. We want to highlight a few items which we strongly support in this bill. My message today is going to be very short and very direct. Keep children experiencing homelessness in foster care or in need of child protective services at the top of the scholarship priority list. If we're going to get serious about breaking the cycle of childhood and family homelessness in Minnesota, we need to advance the policies in this bill that increase access to quality early education programs for children 0 to 5 experiencing homelessness in foster care and in need of child protective services. Research and our experience show that high-quality early education programs that focus on executive function skills and social-emotional skills have a profound and beneficial effect on children experiencing homelessness. In addition, the Mini Minds Coalition wants to thank you for the following items: the $24.6 million in additional money for scholarships. However, more funding is needed to serve all high-need children and families in Minnesota, and the $1.75 million for Parent Aware, but this may not be sufficient funding to support the backbone of the scholarship model, which is the quality rating system. I also want to highlight one area that in the bill where we have a concern, and that is the elimination of the Pathway 2 scholarships. We believe that these scholarships provide additional options for parents to make decisions that is the best program for their children. Again, I want to thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee for your work on this bill and for the opportunity to share my perspectives and the perspectives of the Mini Minds Coalition.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Doslin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doslin. I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I'd like to thank Representative Loon and the members of the committee for all their work this session. I know the numerous bill hearings and having us come knock on your doors and hunt you down can get tiring, so thank you for your work. I also would like to thank Representative Loon for introducing a bill to increase the per pupil formula by 2%. MASA's legislative priority this year is an increase of 3% in the per pupil formula, and appreciate Representative Loon's efforts. We recognize the challenges with the target and that the target didn't accommodate a 3% formula increase. But I do just want to remind members that the per pupil formula is the basic way school districts are funded in Minnesota. It is the primary way school districts provide teacher salaries for the bunch of the work that they do with students. And just a reminder, in order for the per pupil formula to catch up with inflation, would require $550 per pupil. The per pupil formula has not caught up with inflation, and we hope to continue to try to get an additional per pupil increase when this bill moves forward. I'd also like to express our concerns on the elimination of the voluntary pre-K grants. Just a reminder, school districts right now are looking at their budgets, they're creating their classrooms, they're hiring teachers, or they have teachers that they've already hired for the voluntary pre-K programs, and they are enrolling families right now for this next school year. An elimination of voluntary pre-K program right now creates challenges for all of the school districts that have received these pre-K grants. And there's lots of school districts around the state have received the grants. Albert Lea, Burnsville, St. Cloud, Ada Borup, Deer River, Bloomington, Richfield, Greenway, and a whole host of other school districts. This is not a small amount of resources that these school districts have received. I also would just like to raise concerns regarding the delinking of the compensatory formula. You heard that from the Richfield superintendent, so I won't go any further. And then lastly, to end on a positive note, I'd like to thank the members for the support of the Teacher Shortage Act. Thank you.
Thank you. Grace Kelleher.
Thank you.
And Mr. Kroonquist, you're on deck if you're here. Ms. Kelleher.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. And this, we sort of liked some things, and we had some concerns about things. Let me tell you, there's never been a perfect bill yet, so it's sort of like the normal way it goes, at least for MSBA, to respond to your bill itself. First of all, we want to thank you for the attention to the general education formula. We have contended all year that money on the formula is one of the best things we can do for our schools around the state in an equitable way. We appreciate the e-learning days going forward, but we really want you to consider if you get down and tell us whether to use a telephone or whether we have to use a voicemail, that gets prescriptive. So some flexibility there as we get down to the site so we don't have to go out and buy cell phones would be great. We are also happy about the school performance report and disaggregated data. I think that's a real plus forward. The department has been working really hard with folks on it, but that number started to swell to over 100. So I appreciate that going forward. We love all the teacher shortage, and you've got many pieces over, so it's like finding little pits of treasure as we went through. We've got some concern about the targeted compensatory revenue and the connection to the MCAs and the 95%. The only thing we want to share with you is that 95% came from the feds, but the feds also said parents can opt out. And I'm just not sure school districts can even put a brass band in front of their doors to get some of these kids back in. And last but not least, the advertising with PSEO students. If you're going to open that can of worms, if we could just make sure it was factual, maybe open to all the concurrent enrollment, all the college options we have in K-12, so the students get a better representation of the opportunities in front of them. So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Mr. Kroonquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and I'll try to be brief because I know you've heard a lot already. Madam Chair, members, we know you fought hard for a higher target, and we greatly appreciate your efforts. We also understand that you now have to play the cards you've been dealt and that we're still early in the process, and we intend to continue advocating for a significantly higher E-12 target as we move forward. We do want to thank you, as has been mentioned, for the Teacher Shortage Act provisions, especially emphasized on our platform was increasing the teachers of color. Very important that we do that to attack the achievement gap, and we want to keep working hard on that. Also, thank you for putting the language in the concurrent enrollment partnership. That's another critical issue. That's a looming crisis, really, if we don't start to address that. And so we're hoping we can add the funding to that as it moves forward. But again, getting back to the target, we just understand that that didn't allow you to do more than the 1.5%, but as you've heard, that is going to create a challenge for your school districts across the state. When the formula increases by less than inflation, we know two things are going to happen. Number one, your districts are going to have to make budget reductions. Number two, there are going to be a lot of referendums on the ballot this fall. And I testified earlier in the tax committee that we were disappointed that the tax bill is not going to increase the operating referendum equalization. That certainly would have been helpful, and we'll keep advocating for that as well. Just want to reiterate a couple of the testimonies you've heard about delinking the compensatory program. We don't think that's the way to go. If we want to attack the achievement gap, we need to make sure those students get those resources. We also, as Ms. Kelleher just pointed out, are really concerned about starting to tie funding to MCA participation when state law, in fact, explicitly allows students and parents to opt out. And then likewise, you've heard this plenty too, but we are opposed to eliminating Pathway 2 and the VPK program. Our districts have made a lot of decisions, have added on classroom space, hired staff, and we would really like to see those programs move forward. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Kroonquist and Ms. Kelleher. Jim Bartholomew, Stacy Stout, followed by Patrick Lebeko.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, Representative Denton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As these folks, good folks, come up, I haven't seen in my packet district runs. And, of course, that's always of interest.
Yes, and those are being worked on.
As we speak.
Can I watch?
You are.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome. Whoever wants to go first.
Chair Loon, members of the committee. I'm Stacy Stout with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today in support of House File 890. The Minnesota Chamber represents over 2,300 companies who are very concerned about students graduating ready for the world of work. Closing the skills gap in our workforce begins with closing the achievement gap in schools and equipping our students for success after high school. We support the following provisions in this legislation. Early childhood education scholarship funding. Providing low-income families with access to quality early childhood education programs is necessary for improved kindergarten readiness. We believe that early childhood education scholarships are the key to doing this. We favor giving scholarships to those who have trouble affording childcare and allowing them to pick a program that meets quality standards and best meets their family needs. Additionally, Parent Aware itself must continue to be able to incentivize providers statewide to become quality rated. We also support the early education coordination. Coordinating and reforming existing investments is an important step toward making the best use of our public resources to target children with the greatest need. Requiring kindergarten readiness best practices, better tracking of funding, and accountability of existing investments will lead toward outcomes that serve our youngest children best. We also support the teacher staffing flexibility. The requirement that school boards and teachers' bargaining representative must negotiate a process for laying off teachers when they must go through layoffs. This could possibly include the consideration of a teacher's effectiveness over seniority to ensure that teachers who are the most effective are retained. And also we support the encouragement of MCA participation, the language that encourages schools to share information about the MCAs with their families, about expectations for students, their progress relative to our state standards, and options for helping ensure students are prepared. Families will still be able to opt out of the MCAs, but at least the schools will have given them a better understanding of what information and possible help they have available. In summary, this bill aims to close the achievement gap so that every student graduates ready for success after high school and that all Minnesotans are ready for the challenges of a global economy. It's not only important for our students' future, it's important for the success of our businesses and the economy of our state. Thank you.
Thank you. And members, and to the rest of the test bars, by my count, we have, after Mr. Bartholomew, 9. I would really like to finish up so that we could all run to session at 3:30 and not have to come back tonight. So if we can all be very brief, I think we can get there. Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, members, the wild game would be fun. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and we'd like to thank Chair Loon and the committee for all your work in developing House File 890. We especially want to thank you for the bill's focus on meeting the needs of students and families. And this focus is most evident in early education, where you're increasing funding for early education scholarships and giving families more flexibility in choosing effective providers by focusing on Pathway 1, increasing funding for school readiness programs and expanding access through charter schools, increasing the number of Parent Aware rated providers, moving to improve the coordination of selected early education programs, and building support for the 5 education partnerships. The changes you've made for students who either are or may be interested in participating in PSEO are also important, as is the potential expansion of the concurrent enrollment teacher training program. Other provisions in House File 890 that will benefit students and schools include having school boards and their teachers negotiate local policies for determining layoffs while also repealing the state's seniority requirement, continued support for school leaders through the Minnesota Principals Academy, and creating the targeted compensatory revenue program focused on providing extended time opportunities. And since funding for House File 140 is included in this bill, we'd like to express our support and thank Chairs Loon and Erickson for your work to streamline our teacher licensure system. And finally, we support the provision asking the commissioner to forward the state's ESSA plan to you and that you approve the plan prior to implementation. Frankly, if we're going to have consistent expectations and accountability for results, it's important for the legislature and the administration to mutually identify needed changes in law. thank you, and we'd appreciate your passage of House File 890.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Lovejo, followed by Mr. Lundell, followed by Mr. Aronson. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. My name is Patrick Lovejo, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Child Care Association. There are several things about this proposal that we're very pleased to see. We support the goals of creating an Office of Early Education and Development in order to better coordinate and maximize early childhood investments and interventions, including collection of sharing of data necessary to move forward in this area. We are also very excited to see the eligibility for scholarships begin to open up to more infants and toddlers, starting with those children in the highest risk categories. Smart move for both children involved and the targeting of state investments. Of course, we are very pleased to see an increase in state support of scholarships. We have waiting lists and unserved families, and we have research to show that our Minnesota model of scholarships is working. Overall, we are pleased to see this bill and the bold ideas in it. Our main ask is for more overall investments in scholarships, which have been transformational for families and children previously shut out of our state's early childhood options.
Thank you, Mr. Lovejo. Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity and Education. I want to thank you for this opportunity and thank you for all the hard work you've done throughout the legislative session. It was like deja vu all over again when I saw the governor's target of $700 million and then legislative targets coming in below the governor's and well below the governor's target as it was 2 years ago. But I do want to thank you, and I think that you're improving because you were about 20% of the governor's target, 25% 2 years ago, and you're almost up to 40% of the governor's target. So you're moving in the right direction. But I do want to say thank you very much for concentrating on the formula. The basic formula is the engine that funds all school districts. And certainly, it's obvious from your bill that that's where you put the money. And I think that that's a very positive outcome in all of this. We do value that. I do think we have some concerns about the bill, and I say this kind of guardedly because I know that if you look at the targeted compensatory, my guess is many C districts would benefit from that change. But we're not an organization that says bigger than neighbor, and I think that if we look at Representative Erdahl has his study in there, and I think this is a kind of initiative that probably needs to run through a study like that to see what the distributional effects would be. There are some other things that we would have liked to have seen. We have a number of districts in the voluntary pre-K. We have a number of districts working with Pathway 2. The elimination of those programs would be very, very difficult. The pension thing that was in the governor's bill, the pension help, I think that was something that we would like as well. And just finally, I guess, the disappointment shared with Mr. Kuhnquist that the disappointment we have about not getting a hearing on Representative McDonald's 1381. There's a constant ping-pong game that goes on between the Education Committee and the Tax Committee as to where that should sit. We honestly believe that should sit in the Tax Committee's target. We'd have liked to have had a hearing here because we have some districts that are going to be very strapped moving into the fall and considering referenda. And I think that having that help with the referendum and debt service equalization would have been very, very helpful for those districts. But it didn't get there, and I think we'll keep pushing, and we'll also keep working with you. We'll keep working with the governor. We'll work with the Senate to try to move that target up and to better serve students and school districts throughout the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Roger Ernst, and I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principals Association. There's just a few things that have been touched on by some others, but maybe not highlighted too much. Obviously, we appreciate the inclusion of the funding for the Principals Academy here at the University of Minnesota. The ongoing professional development for principals is very, very important. You know that we testified about some of the concerns on the PSEO provisions. We appreciate the language that you put in the bill regarding the grade weighting. I think that's a very good provision, and I think we heard what you want us to do on that. We'll develop some policies on that. The other provision about kids being in schools, I think that might need a little bit of tweak, but we think you've really moved in the right direction on that. And actually had a very nice conversation with one of the parents about the individual circumstance this morning, and we're going to work to get that fixed as well. One of the things I wanted to mention to you is that the BOSA funding, the Board of School Administrators funding, is buried in the bill here, and you're going to track that funding differently in the future, where the dues monies that the individuals pay or the fees annually get put into the account. BOSA could actually use a few more dollars for their operations. currently the state collects more in dues that actually then go to the organization for the funding, and they think they could actually improve that a bit. So we'd ask that you look at that as we go on and visit about that. We've been very happy, though, with Senator Representative Erickson keeping BOZA as it is. One of the things that is most important to the secondary principals, obviously, are the concurrent enrollment in college and the schools programs, and that funding doesn't go up, it stays static, and obviously that's part of your target issues as well. But the costs in that program are going to go up because Minnesota State is going to charge us more for those courses in the future. They've told us that. We'd ask that as this goes on and your target may expand, that might be on your list as a place to put some of the additional monies we hope that come forward in the system as we move on. We do like working with your staff very, very much and the members of the committee. I might say Mr. Kennedy told me it was funny hat day today. Looking around the room, I think maybe that was a fib on his part. I do have a hat in my briefcase, but I'm going to get them. April Fool's is around the corner.
Always confirm with the chair, Mr. All right. Let's see here. Fred Nolan, Paul Spees, and then Allison Berglum Johnson.
Hello, I'm Fred Nolan, the Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association, and I want to thank the committee and the chair and the staff for all the work on this bill and for your patience today to hear all of the different testifiers. We want to go on the record on some issues. We want to talk about some things that we think need some more work. First of all, we believe that 2 and 2 in the formula is what schools need. We appreciate Chairman Loon, your bill earlier. We hope you can return to that. We don't support delinking compensatory revenue from the formula. Greater Minnesota has significant poverty both in our regional center school districts and our very rural school districts, similar to issues faced by the urban core. Rural school leaders have seen the value of early education to get students ready for school and for the goals of the world's best workforce. There's genuine and widespread interest among rural school leaders to expand VPK, as you can see in the map shared by the commissioner. And also, for rural schools, Pathway 2 fills the need so we can plan and hire teachers so they're there when students show up in the fall. And also not reimbursing all students to take nationally normed exams, ACT or SAT, and only reimbursing free reduced run students, we think will significantly reduce participation in rural Minnesota. This is the wrong way to go. This is being penny wise and pound foolish. There's some things that are going in the right direction. We ask for some more work on the following. Establishing a state partnership in language for credentialing of teachers for concurrent enrollment is excellent, but there needs to be state funding to make this a viable option for teachers and districts to continue to offer these college credit classes for students. The alternate Grow Your Own teacher prep program is great language. We wish reconsideration of the restriction to only districts with more than 40% minority students. We could use programs like this in many rural districts. And finally, fixing the issues related to the access to school buildings and computer technology for online PSEO students is a great step. It fixes the problem for students. But we ask that you dive deeper into the enrollment accounting for these students and the raw economics of public school funding. We're looking for fairness in the funding of online PSEO when districts are expected to supervise students, provide space and technology, when districts lose formula and local operating referendums under the traditional PSEO rules. Thank you for your time. We look forward to working with you as the bill moves forward.
Thank you, Mr. Nolan. Mr. Spees.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Paul Spees with the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota. I'm sorry some of my colleagues couldn't be here today at this time. I'd like to first of all say last week we were here to testify in support of Representative Erickson's Teacher Shortage Act and several provisions, and said we needed to do more, though, to increase the percentage from 4% in the state that we're currently at. Since then, an article in the Star Tribune this past Sunday appeared, and we've just been handed that article talking about the need and the problems that school districts have in hiring teachers of color. We'd like to thank you for several of the provisions in the bill and say where specifically things could be done budget neutral to improve and address the teacher shortage. Thank you for maintaining the American Indian Teacher Prep program funding. Thank you for small increases in expanding Q and paraprofessional the pathway, grow your own programs, and for the expanding loan forgiveness to teachers in shortage areas. However, with the teacher loan forgiveness program, that's $4 million in fiscal year 18. That is not addressing the biggest need that teachers have, and that is with student teaching. The financial needs of student teaching are great, and that's contributing greatly to the teacher shortage in our state. So in Senator Representative Erickson's teacher shortage bill, that provision was there, and we encourage you to consider an amendment that would be budget neutral to transfer money from loan forgiveness to the teacher shortage student teaching grant. The other thing would be to expand the Q funding and to make that more equitable between the alternative teacher prep programs and the expanded Q competitive grant programs. Thank you for your work, and just want to remind everybody that in 2016 the legislature passed several statute changes that said that the state has a requirement as an expectation to provide all students with equitable access to effective and diverse teachers. To just move from 4% to 5%, that would be 600 more teachers of color. It's just not going to do it with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spies. Ms. Berglund-Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Hold on a second. Sorry. Okay. I am here as a graduate of the Perpich Center of Arts Education. I can tell you, if it were not for Perpich, I would not have graduated high school.
And I'm sorry, can you say, we need you to say your name for the...
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Allison Berglund-Johnson.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for reminding me. In my teen years, migraines disabled me at times. I was frequently ill, particularly my freshman year and my senior year. My freshman year was at a small rural school district in southwestern Minnesota. Unfortunately, that school was hostile to my disability in a myriad of ways, including many specific teachers' actions, including publicly in the classroom. I failed several classes that year. I recovered academically and medically. My senior year of high school, I was at Perpich as a new senior. I lived in the dorms, and again, I had disabling migraines. I was immediately offered a 504 IEP plan. The things on my plan were so simple, and I believe they were nearly all cost neutral. I'm incredibly proud to say I graduated from Perpich in Lit with honors in 1999. As a high school student, my art area was led by an MFA level writer who paid careful attention to all of our work. Perpich prepared me to be a working artist in that I learned to pursue projects, in to work collaboratively, and to value interdisciplinary practice. In my time since Perpich, I have done residencies at the Vermont Studio Center, at the Arts Retreat, at New York Mills Regional Cultural Center, funded by the Jerome Foundation. I've been published in literary journals, and as well as on the NPR website, as well as other journalistic publications. I've worked as a teaching artist with those with disabilities. The interdisciplinary emphasis of the Perpich Center has had a profound impact on my own practice. At present, I'm co-editor of a book project based at Minneapolis Community and Technical College, which brings together short creative nonfiction pieces from diverse students, faculty, and staff. I ask you to please not abolish this Perpich Center for Arts Education. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for being here. Mr. Downham, Ms. Gilbert.
Madam Chair, members, Josh Downham, and I'll give two clients in one in 2 minutes. First of all, the Serve Minnesota, which is the state's commission on national community service, oversees AmeriCorps programs, greatly appreciates the additional investments in Reading Corps and Math Corps. Those are making real differences for kids around the state, and there are greater requests from schools. In fact, we can only meet about two-thirds of the requests, and so we'd like to work with you, hopefully, in the future if additional resources are available to expand those. For the Minneapolis Public Schools, Want to thank you, Madam Chair, for, number one, having Alicia Robinson here before the committee from Nassau. And just wanted to say that it was really important because there was a young lady from Fair Downtown School who happened to be in the audience, young African-American woman who has an interest in aeronautics. Just happened that she was in the building. She got to meet Ms. Robinson, told her that she had tried to get into an aeronautics program in Washington, D.C. Ms. Robinson gave her her contact information. That meeting very likely changed the trajectory of that young woman's career. And so when I look at this bill, I kind of think about in that terms. Is this bill changing the trajectory of educational and opportunity for our students who need it the most? And in some instances, it is. And I want to thank you for putting Representative Lee's provision in that provides late-arriving English learners with an additional year in early middle college. Granted, it's a very small provision, but I really hope we can work together in future biennia or sessions to grow that. I really believe that's the future of high school and blended with college. But we do have two real serious concerns with this bill. The first is the fact that getting rid of DPK and Pathway 2 will mean that 300 Minneapolis families will lose pre-K. Those letters just went in the mail this week. And so it's troubling because those are at our highest poverty sites, and those students that are in those are the ones that we want to help move the needle on for, in terms of the achievement gap. And for VPK in particular, we were able to establish a program at our teen mother's school in Longfield and Representative Dabney's district. And that program has seen lower rates of absenteeism now that the students are actually on site. And I see Mr. Kennedy's giving me the time signal. So I will simply say that the delinking comp ed and attaching it to MCAs is a real concern, and I'll visit more with you privately. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gilbert. And just so folks know, we are up against a hard 3:30 session time. So,
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I will be very brief. I could echo everything that the previous testifiers have said, and I do appreciate that you've come to our school and worked with me and the district on several issues. And we, like everybody else, do have a bigger target. The two issues of most concern to the district is the delinking compensatory and changing the formula based on the test scores. And you know, based on our compensatory hearing, will mean a loss of counselors and reading and math support, EL services, co-talk classes. All of those are going to be at risk. As far as pre-K, the bill could potentially have a $1.8 million cut to our pre-K programs. And as I know we discussed this before, as far as supplanting versus supplant, in 2012, we had a little over 1,000 students in 38 half-day classrooms and no all-day. In 2016, we had over 1,900 students in 48 half-day classrooms, 11 all-day class, 48 half-day, 11 all-day, and 10 child partners. And just as Mr. Down had mentioned, we will be sending out our notices about enrollment in the mail, too, and this is going to create quite a perplexing situation for us about what we're going to tell parents about moving forward for this fall.
Thank you. Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beth Frazier with the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. I apologize for adding myself on at the end. I thought my colleague, Aaron Gutsky, had signed up to testify, but he apparently did not and then was not able to make it. I understand you have a smaller target. We are worried about the decrease in funding for the adult basic education. And one of the community programs that's funded is specifically for deaf individuals. Some of those individuals are American citizens, have always been American citizens, but American Sign Language is not the same as English. There is no written form, and so they may have gone through school without learning English. There are other people who are immigrants who actually have come to this country with no language. Unlike immigrants in other ABE programs, because they couldn't hear, they may not have learned any language. And so the challenge for teaching these people is first they have to teach them American Sign Language, and then second they need to teach them English. I want to thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you very much. We do have to adjourn. We have to get to the floor session, so committee is adjourned. Thank you.